This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Vigeland. Tonight on After Paradise, it's been 29 days since the campfire started. Toxic debris removal from burned out properties has already begun. Now Butte County is asking fire victims to sign up to allow cleanup of the rest of the materials. We'll have details. Plus, a North State nonprofit is giving the Red Cross $100,000 to help replace medical devices and glasses that were lost to the fire. And the author of a book about grief talks about the best ways for friends, family, and coworkers to help victims through the recovery process. We want to hear your questions and comments. Leave a message for us at 433-4887 or on our website, mynspr.org. For Friday, December 7th, 2018, this is After Paradise. It's been 1 month since the campfire destroyed some 18,000 structures. Authorities have searched and cleared each of those properties and are confident there are no more human remains. Property owners are slowly being allowed to return to witness the damage and to salvage anything that might have survived the fire. On Monday, Butte County will open what it's calling a Right of Reentry Center, where homeowners can go and fill out permission forms for the county's debris removal program. Casey Hatcher is a spokesperson for the county.
The right of entry form is required for property owners to give access to the government-sponsored debris removal program so that they can go on their property and remove the fire-related debris. So that debris program happens in two phases, and the first phase is the removal of the household hazardous waste. That phase is automatic, and it's already underway. But the second phase is removing the rest of the fire-related debris. And so the state, Cal OES, and its CalRecycle partner is running that program to remove that fire-related debris, and property owners have to sign a right of entry form to give them access to be on their private property.
Let's quickly go through those two elements of the process. What is happening right now?
So phase one of the debris removal program is both US EPA and California Department of Toxic Substances Control is going through to remove household hazardous waste on those properties that were damaged or destroyed by the fire. And they're only working on areas that have already been opened up, so those evacuation orders have been lifted and residents have been given an opportunity to return to those areas. So that's underway right now.
So what that means is that if you're worried about someone going onto your property, removing things before you've seen it, that is not going to happen.
That's correct.
Okay. And what does phase two involve?
So phase two is cleaning up the rest of the fire-related debris that is left when structures burn. And that is a government-sponsored program. So the state, Cal OES, and Cal Recycle is the actual contractor that will do that. They will hire contractors to come in and remove that debris. But since it's private property, they need the permission of the property owners to actually come on and do that removal. And the right of entry form is what grants them access to do that.
All right. Butte County Public Information Officer Casey Hatcher joining us to talk about the papers that you need to go sign if you are a fire victim in order for your property to get the proper cleanup. Casey, thank you.
You're welcome.
And you can find details on the right of reentry centers at buttecountyrecovers.org. A North State nonprofit has given a $100,000 grant to the American Cross to help provide emergency cash for campfire victims. The funds are helping people replace everything from lost medications and eyeglasses to walkers, canes, and other medical devices. NSPR's Sarah Bohannon talked with Larry Olmsted, president and CEO of the United Way of Northern California, for details about the partnership.
We ourselves are giving $500 grants to people who lost their homes in the fire. One of the things we know is that we want to get as much money out as quickly as we can to as many folks as we can. So we engaged the Red Cross because we know, of course, that the Red Cross is working directly on the ground with survivors of the campfire incident, as they do in the case of almost any significant disaster. We can count on the Red Cross, of course, to be operating shelters and to do all kinds of activities. So we've given this grant to them. They operate a program that helps folks transition out of the shelters. They are providing items, money, and other assistance that allows this population in particular to access items that they need. One thing we know, for example, is that this is a population that skews a little bit older than the typical population that you might see in a California disaster. So things like medical supplies, for instance, become very important. Another item that's really important for folks is the ability to have funds for transportation, because folks are trying to transport themselves to relatives' homes, for instance, or just to get around town to access all the various services that need to be provided. We are providing funds to individuals and families to help them do that, and we just wanted to give the Red Cross some assets because we know that they are close on the ground working with these individuals as well, just to get these assets out as quickly as we can.
Do you know how many applications have been received and then how many checks have been issued?
Yeah, we can talk certainly about United Way's programs, where already we've received in excess of 5,000 applications for emergency cash assistance. We are expecting that we're going to receive somewhere between 8,000 and 10,000. We've been aggressively fundraising. Have to really thank our donors. We have individual donors, institutional donors, companies, foundations from all across the country that are stepping up to try to assist the survivors of this fire. Already we've started distributing checks. We're at about 1,000 already, and we expect to continue to distribute checks to campfire survivors, to meet the need, which as I said, we expect might be as many as 8,000, 9,000, 10,000, somewhere in that range.
The United Way has created funds before in these types of disasters. Can you speak to this disaster versus others?
One thing that has become very clear to me as I've talked to survivors at the Disaster Recovery Center is that a large percentage of the people involved in this wildfire, first of all, faced a traumatic situation simply departing Paradise or Magalia or their community. In other words, it's one thing, there's an evacuation coming, and I've been in places, for instance, hurricanes or what have you, or even a wildfire where you have time that, okay, it's coming, I have time to get out. We have a lot of people here who are simply running for their lives, who really were not sure whether they would survive the evacuation. So that's one level of trauma that as social service workers and caregivers, we have to be conscious of as we go forward. The other thing that's a real factor here, I think, is that, we have not only homes destroyed, but in essence, a town and a community for practical terms, doesn't really exist. So you have a lot of jobs gone. You have a lot of the level of economic hardship increases tremendously, and the psychological impact of all that. And I think the third thing is that the scale and scope of the number of people who have been displaced or impacted by the fire is huge. The number of people displaced, the question will be in the greater Butte County community, how do we absorb that? And that's going to be a real challenge for the community going forward. I think what we're seeing is that, as one would expect, the community is going to step up. If you're someone who wants to give to something, I'll tell you, this is the disaster that you want to make that donation.
That was Larry Olmsted of the United Way of Northern California talking with NSPR's Sarah Bohannon. You can donate to the United Way's Emergency Financial Assistance Fund at norcalunitedway.org. In every fire, some people choose to ignore evacuation orders. It frustrates fire officials, but in some cases, the people who stay behind have been able to save their homes. Sharon McNary of our sister station KPCC in Los Angeles says this raises a difficult policy question.
On the night the Thomas Fire broke out last December, it raced toward Clear Point, a hilly neighborhood of hundreds of homes in Ventura.
Mandatory into Clear Point, please, and onto Londo.
Ventura City officials ordered a mandatory evacuation. But Adam Mango stayed to protect his mother's house. The wind-driven fire pelted her home with embers, starting spot fires that he put out with water from the hot tub.
The flames did come in. It was touching the house, and I was using buckets after buckets and crawling on my hands and knees. I mean, it was a spiritual moment.
The Thomas Fire burned most of his neighbors' homes, but he saved his mom's house. Mango was better prepared than most. He'd worked briefly as a firefighter. He told fire experts their evacuation orders should include people like him.
The plans just don't include residents who are prepared, able-bodied, and want to stay and actually help the firefighting efforts.
He got immediate pushback from Ventura City Fire Department Assistant Chief Matt Brock.
And you had a plan. It's that simple. Yeah. The general public doesn't, and that's just the difference.
This is the dilemma fire officials face in every big fire. They know people stay behind, about 10%, according to a U.S. Forest Service study. But officially, the state doesn't want to do anything that could be interpreted as encouraging people to stay. CAL FIRE Deputy Director Mike Mueller says California has no policy to train people how to save their homes if they disregard an evacuation order.
We do not support that at all, and I think it could give the false sense of security to the public.
He says it's a matter of liability for the state. But in 2009, state and local fire officials considered adopting a new policy called Leave Early or Stay and Defend. It was modeled on a long-standing practice in Australia. But that year, a disastrous series of fires in Australia killed 173 people who did not evacuate or who got caught in the fire. That's why California firefighters' official slogan is Ready, Set, Go. Prepare your home to withstand fire and then get out when authorities tell you to. I'm Sharon McNary in Los Angeles.
You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. We'll have more just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the campfire from North State Public Radio. I'm Tess Viglund. Every holiday season, the Forest Service allows the public to cut down a number of trees for a small fee. Capital Public Radio's Ezra David Romero explores whether this practice could be ramped up to thin California's forests and potentially reduce fire danger.
Susie Coker's cut her Christmas tree down for 25 years.
Are you ready?
She's with her grandson and son-in-law near Lake Tahoe.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Timber!
Coker purchased a permit for $10 from the Lake Tahoe Basin Management Unit that sold 2,000 permits.
I am looking for a tree that has enough branches that I can put a ton of ornaments on it.
Nearly three-quarters of the state's national forests allow Christmas tree sales. Coker's also a forest advisor for the UC system.
It's a great win-win solution. You get the public out in the forest, you do good work reducing the density of the trees.
Coker says the visitor experience program could be ramped up even more to have forest benefits. But there are issues like administrative fees and weather. One acreage on the Tahoe National Forest could support the removal of 50,000 trees, said Joseph Flannery in Truckee.
I just don't think it'd be feasible for 50,000 people to kind of be driving through this neighborhood to go collect trees.
The Tahoe National Forest plans on increasing sales next year. The Plumas National Forest sells around 9,000 permits a year and has no cap, says Leanne Trammell with the agency.
We have lots and lots and lots of small trees, but is it making a dent in the thinning issue that we have? Not so much.
She also says people want the prettiest trees and may shun the Charlie Browns of the forest. In Sacramento, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Some of the most captivating images of the campfire and aftermath have been captured by freelance photojournalist Noah Berger. Among other assignments, Berger has been chronicling wildfires around the state for well over a decade. His work has appeared in every major newspaper in the country. NSPR's Mark Albert caught up with him by phone at his home in Alameda.
You've been covering wildfires and disasters for quite some time, and you were one of the first people up during the campfire. What did you see? How did you get there so quickly, and what was your initial reaction?
Well, you could tell us, you know, as soon as I see a new start, you know, I research the conditions, the wind, the humidity, the temperatures, the forecast, the slope alignment of the flames, and you could tell within the first hour that the campfire was going to be massive. And, you know, listening to the scanner traffic from my home, I could tell that it was time to go. So I left Alameda sometime around 7:30 in the morning and got up there about 11:30 or so. And it was definitely hard to get in. I came in off Pence Road, and the first roadblock took some effort to get through because they were trying to get all the people out of Paradise. Kind of ran into a wall of smoke and had to wait a little bit until I could see, you know, 10 or 15 feet, enough to drive through. When I first came to that wall of smoke, it was just solid. But then on the scanner, I was hearing about Feather River Hospital and wanted to get to that. So me and Justin Sullivan from Getty Images, who were riding together, we pushed on through that and made it up to the hospital.
Quite a harrowing scene as patients were being rushed out to the tarmac, and apparently they couldn't get helicopters in because of the smoke. What was the scene like? How were people staying composed?
You know, it was a pretty intense visual there. When we got there, they had moved all the emergency patients onto that helipad and moved all the equipment out there, and it was a really wild scene. You had the flames and smoke in the background. You know, parts of the hospital were burning, and these patients are kind of covered in blankets and, you know, looking around outdoors where obviously they normally wouldn't be. And they were trying to get them into cars, and everybody was just scrambling. Hard to do that.
Now, Noah, you are an extremely accomplished photographer. You shoot corporate executives. You are at crime scenes. You're at news events around the Bay Area and throughout California and around the nation. What particularly about wildfire has drawn you into making that so much part of your specialty?
Wildfire is just to witness that and to be in that environment and see the destruction and the power and the fury of nature is pretty impressive as a photographer. As a person, obviously it's not enjoyable if you live up there and you have people who are affected by it, but to come in as press and see that is an amazing experience to have. You also strip off the layers of normal life that are annoying and tedious, you know, dealing with emails, taking the garbage out, all of that just disappears, and you spend 4 or 5 days just immersed in this environment of trying to get the best photos you can.
Now, you've shot so many tremendous images. Can you walk me through some of your favorites, some of the most evocative photographs from this particular fire, and what makes the frame for you? How do you build a photograph?
From this fire, some of my favorites are actually the aftermath. Even though I was there for the main part of the fire coming through Paradise and down Skyway, you couldn't really capture the magnitude of the whole town burning in a single frame. It just wasn't possible. You could see a couple of buildings in some frames. Some of the aftermath pictures that just show the desolation and some of the human moments. I followed one woman who is living with her five-person family in a hotel room in Yuba City, and they were getting ready for their first day of school going back since the fire. And to see the effect on people's lives and to meet those people kind of lends itself to making good images.
How do you cope with the reality around you and sort of armor yourself to walk into life and death situations?
It's a good question. I'm not as affected by death as some other things. I've covered a lot of death and, you know, I've seen a lot of bodies. What doesn't work at me is when you see people being really ugly to other people. That's something that affects me emotionally. One thing that is hard right now, I'm back home in Alameda, and it is hard to leave that world and come back to normal life. Your head and mind are just there, and nothing outside of there really has any power, you know, family or other jobs. It's hard to get your head in the game on that when you're just so focused on Paradise.
Noah, I missed you at the car fire, but you've been covering these for 10, 15 years. Is there anything in particular, and I know as being on the ground, it's all anecdotal, but are you noticing any change in the fires yourself?
For sure, we're noticing some changes. Every year for the past 4 years, we've had a fire where we say, wow, this is insane. It can't get any bigger than this. This is going to be the craziest thing we've seen. And then the next year, unbelievably, you have something that dwarfs that. I mean, we had that with the Rocky Fire, the Valley Fire, you know, the fires in Lake County. And then, of course, last year, Santa Rosa. I mean, I came out of there saying I'll never see anything like this in my life again. This was it. And then you have Paradise. The campfire was the craziest thing that I've been in, more than other fires. Normally, I feel like I know fire behavior well, but then when you run up against something like that fire tornado that was a mile from me, like that's something you can't prepare for. So I'm not really knowledgeable enough to draw long-term conclusions from this, but I mean, in the last 4 years, we've definitely seen these ramp up in fury and intensity and the scale of destruction and life loss.
Noah Berger, a freelance photographer working for the Associated Press and others throughout this fire season, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Mark. Nice talking to you.
We heard yesterday from a survivor of both Hurricanes Katrina and Harvey, who said the most important thing you need to remember in the aftermath of this kind of crisis is to ask for help when you need it. That's not easy. Thousands of people in our community are now moving through the grieving process following the loss of homes and lives. Megan Devine is the author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. And she joins me now. Megan, let's start with, what are the signs of grief? What should you be watching out for as we move through this disaster recovery process?
Because we're so weird about grief in this culture, we think that grief is this terrible, awful thing that you need to get through as quickly as possible. We don't really understand what healthy, normal grieving is. Healthy, normal grieving hurts. It's incredibly painful. It can mess with your sleep. It can mess with your appetite. It certainly makes interpersonal challenges even harder and even bigger. The things that I would really be concerned about, the things to watch for, are certainly feelings of suicidality or self-harm, which, while very normal and not at all uncommon in a loss of this magnitude, they are things that you want to get some support so that you can get through. Things like not eating at all, right? The one big thing to remember here is to tend your own organism. Eating, sleeping, getting enough water, all of those things to help your body survive what it's being asked to survive. Anytime those body mechanisms are starting to shut down or you're not caring for yourself physically, those are the times to check in with somebody to see what kind of support you can get around your grief.
What are some of the signs that people perhaps may not immediately recognize in terms of their own capacity to deal with a crisis of this magnitude? What might surprise them in terms of how they're feeling?
Gosh, I think everything, right? Everything can be surprising because you've never had to live through this before. We see catastrophe in movies and on television, or we see other people's lived catastrophes from a distance, and we think, oh, I wouldn't respond that way, or I would probably respond like this. But when you have to live it, it's very, very different. So I think we can be surprised by anything. People can be surprised by not having much of an emotional response at all. Again, I think that can be part of the shock, that protective cocoon that can be around you as you just deal with the immediate things in front of you. I think anger can be really surprising. Anger at any number of things, including things that are maybe justifiable and things that maybe don't seem justifiable. Anger can be a really big surprise. Even moments of, I don't want to say joy, but peace or connection can feel really weird in the face of a loss of this magnitude, right? How dare we find any contentment or laugh at anything? One thing I really want to stress is that any response you have to a loss of this magnitude is not wrong, right? Again, the only time I really get concerned is when self-harm or suicidality or emotional flooding, which is when your emotions are too big for the space you're in. Everything else is part of being human, responding to a uncommon and abnormal situation. So I think everything can be surprising.
You mentioned earlier that sometimes the grief process is made even harder by the culture that we live in. What do you mean?
Yeah, we've got such a belief in this culture that happiness is equal to health, and that's just not accurate. We've got this way of sort of quote-unquote supporting each other by spouting off platitudes. Everything happens for a reason. Those things are really cruel when you've just had your entire life destroyed, and there isn't any good reason for any of this. And so coming back out into the world that deals with even everyday grief and everyday losses with sort of a cavalier, get over it attitude sort of thing, you come out with such a catastrophic loss that people really feel helpless around, don't know what to say. And so we lean on our ideas of how we take care of each other. And unfortunately, those ideas aren't super useful.
Then what are some ideas that are super useful? If we are the family, if we are the friends, the colleagues of people who are suffering at this point, what can we be doing for them?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's not enough to say everybody's terrible at this. Thinking about what can we do instead, I think the biggest thing to remember is that acknowledgement of someone's pain is the best medicine, right? I'm so sorry this happened. Do you want to tell me about it? How can I help, right? We often ask people who are suffering, let me know if you need anything. Well, the grieving person doesn't have the energy to figure out what they need and then figure out who might be able to fill that need and then make a phone call or send a text to ask for it. So if you want to be supportive to a grieving person or a grieving community, it's much better to offer tangible things. Can I be the person you forward your mail to? Can I be the person who is sort of your point person? All of these people want to ask questions or see if you're doing, and that can be really overwhelming. Can I field those for you? Tangible actions to help the grieving person tend to their own heart.
And how about some tangible actions for those who are in the midst of the grieving process? What are some really very real life things that they can do to help themselves through an event like this?
First thing first, right? As I said earlier, tend the organism, eating, sleeping, drinking. That seems really like weird and surface. And how am I supposed to deal with a loss of this magnitude by making sure I'm drinking enough water? And the thing is that, again, your body and your mind are being asked to absorb something that can't be absorbed. And so we want to do whatever we can to support your body doing the best it can to pay attention and to stay alive and to care for yourself. So big thing is tending the organism. Other things, talking about it, reaching out to other survivors, being able to tell the truth about your own experience without somebody taking that away from you is a huge relief. And then also looking for small moments of companionship or peace alongside the devastation. Again, that can seem really impossible, especially in these early days. But any moment where you feel the slightest piece of being or ease, we want to look for more of those. Not as a way to take away your grief, but as a way to companion yourself beside it. What I can say is that the way that you survive this is by telling the truth, by companioning each other, and being really fierce about your own survival and not letting an outside narrative of rising above sit in you if it doesn't feel real for you, right? This is your story to live out, and you will find your way by listening to yourself and by listening to your other community members and finding the way forward that is beautiful and painful. Both things are true.
Megan Devine is the author of It's Okay That You're Not Okay, Grief and Loss in a Culture That Doesn't Understand. Megan, thank you.
You're so welcome.
And that is our program for Friday, December 7th, 2018, 29 days since the fire started. We are produced by Sarah Bohannon, Mark Albert, and Phil Wilkie. Adam Ragusea composed our theme music. Special thanks today to John Sepulvedo. Tune in Monday when we take you along as debris cleanup crews make their way through the burned-out properties in Paradise and beyond. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.